Hello, and welcome to the Mail Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Chris Marshall of the Clickit Comics Library.
In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. All right, the numbers we're going to be talking about in this episode are the top 300 trade sales for October 2011 through Diamond to retailers. So this is, of course, what's going into the stores. They like to have things on their shelf, so not all of this is sold to readers, of course. You know, this was a really, really interesting month. Obviously, there was a lot of big activity on the comic book side. Bob and I have already kind of talked about that, but we can touch on that some here because it's kind of big.
Sure.
And on the trade side, it was a little bit of a lackluster month. I mean, the top item on the trade side did about 5,646 units, which is, frankly, kind of low. I did some quick stats, and, you know, if you look for the entire final order era, the average for that top-ranked item is around 11,484 units. Now, if you compare to just, you know, the last calendar year, so going, say, from October 2010 through September 2011, the average is really almost pretty close to that with 11,330 units. So a little under that by, what, about 150 units or so?
Yeah, just about, yeah.
So, you know, the fact that our top item here is about, what, half that, kind of shows, really, I mean, the top of the list is kind of a very volatile area. We've had a couple items a couple of months ago. We had one that did around 23,000 units. A month before that, a little over 20,000 units. But we've also had one month where the top item, I believe that was in January, was below 4,000 units. So, really, I mean, this list is at the mercy of did something really big come out or not.
Mm-hmm.
And this month, I think a lot of the retail dollars were allocated more on the comic side.
Yeah.
Because it was, again, just a gangbusters month for DC with their number twos coming out. 51 of the 52 new 52 titles, the first issues placed again on the list. So, I mean, that was just amazing.
Now, well, and also, if you're looking at the, not only are we having the number twos come out, but a couple of number ones from Incredible Hulk and Wolverine.
You know, it's interesting.
And they're wrapping up Fear itself, too. So there's a lot of things going on the Marvel side, too.
Well, let's touch on that for a second because, I mean, Marvel usually dominates on the comics side, not so much on the trade side. They usually come in first about, you know, a third of the time versus on the comic side almost always, except for lately, last 2 months. And their top three items this time around, Incredible Hulk number one, you mentioned, 106,472 estimated units. Wolverine and the X-Men number one, 59,855 estimated units. We have seen times in the past where they would have a strong first issue like this. Next issue would be like half that or down maybe 60%. We've seen that on the X-Men side a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
So while these are good first issues, the fact that Wolverine and the X-Men didn't crack 100,000 actually, you know, is, to me, I'm not going to say it's worrisome, but, mm-hmm. you know, it cools my expectations and does make me wonder about how those second issues are going to do. And then that Fear itself, I mean, yes, there's the 7.1, 0.2, and 0.3 shenanigans.
Yeah.
But really, 7 is the final issue, and it did 95,599 estimated units. And of course, that eighth issue will never exist, so they're going to lose all those sales next month. Next highest
item. Was that supposed to be an eight issue series?
No, it's just 7. That's my point. There will be no 8.
Oh, okay, right.
So that's 95,96,000.
Well, not only that, John, but look at the prices on those books. Those retailed, Hulk and Wolverine and the X-Men, both $3.99. Fear itself, $4.99. And yeah, they're both, you know, they're all extra size and extra pages, but that's a lot for the wallet these days when DC's at $2.99.
Yes. Well, and I think DC is playing the long game here. And
they
this
are.
Is something that's going to be very interesting to see reflected on the trade side
mm-hmm.
of how is the pricing going to going to compare between Marvel and DC in 5, 6, 8 months or whatever from now. Because DC has been exceedingly good in 2011 about holding the line at $2.99.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, they've got a couple of books at the $3.99 price point, but those have extra story pages.
The Justice League, yeah.
The All-Star Western.
Action.
Action, Men of War, and I forget what the other one is, although I'm sure it's somewhere on the screen in front of me if I were to look hard enough. But when all of those get collected to the trade side, are we going to start to see a potential $5 difference in cost between a DC trade and a Marvel trade? And if so, I mean, that's really a competitive advantage for DC.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll see how that plays out, but you know, if they can kind of maintain that price difference, it's good for DC. I mean, that Fear itself at $4.99, I mean, that's pretty hefty.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, major event and final issue where everything kind of pulls together in theory, you know, it did pretty well for them. It was actually up a bit from the previous issue. The worrisome thing for me at Marvel, those were the only three that were really noticeably above 60,000 units. Uncanny X-Men down at rank 22 there was 212 units above 60,000. Pretty big difference between that and Fear itself. Now, if these sales are indicative of the deltas that we're going to see between these respective items over on the trade side, I mean, that's a pretty big difference there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, I think when we see Fear itself over on the trade side, it stands a pretty good chance of topping the list. I think.
Depending what else is out that month, like
another
Walking Dead or something like that. But yeah, it's going to be top five for sure.
Well, even against a Walking Dead, a Fables, some of the other perennial top, ranking items, Fear itself will do respectably.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know if I can say that about Incredible Hulk and Wolverine and the X-Men.
Right.
Really, I mean, that's the difference between those being the first issue, and we've seen all of Fear itself, of course. But, you know, it's one of those things that, with all the activity on the comics side, on DC, with the reorders of the number one and stuff like that, it really makes me also question how are those going to do when they hit the trade side in a couple of months or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people will have read them, you know, and add to that the day-and-date digital release. People who want stuff at 2 in the morning or whatever, bam, they can just go online, get it, and they've got it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not I should wait for the comic. Oh, I don't want to go get to the store. Gee, we'll wait for the trade or whatever. I think we're in a point where the sales dynamics could really start to change in a number of different ways, and it's really too early to tell even what basic direction some of the stuff's going to go in. The digital thing obviously is the top of a lot of people's minds. We talked, I think, a little bit last month about how the Comixology app was the top grossing app for a couple of weeks running. And I took a little bit closer look at the phrasing of the press release this time around, where it was saying it was the top grossing app for the last 8 Wednesdays. Note it says Wednesdays. Now, maybe that doesn't matter, but I mean, Wednesday, New Comic Book Day, okay, that makes sense. They'd get the lion's share of the sales on that day, whatever. I really think at this point, because we don't have any ability to really quantify those digital sales, you got to read what they say very carefully. And I don't say take it with a grain of salt, but be careful how you interpret that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hopefully the digital stuff is doing well. I think it's going to be, it looks like right now, additive to the market, but given how, you know, sales are usually trending down, I can't say that it's not subtracting a little also, but I think the net effect is definitely positive.
Well, if nothing else, there's just a lot of publicity and PR when it comes to digital these days. I mean, you turn on any comic book resources article and there is a digital article every single day. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's in our face and it's here to stay.
Well, I guess the question
for sure
I would have for that is, it's in our face.
Right.
Is it in the face of the people where it needs to be, those of us not already reading comics?
Right. That's true. They are preaching to the choir. You know, I mean, just today I saw that, what was it, Top Shelf launched a new app,
mm-hmm.
which is great, but yeah, they're you know, they're giving the press release out to, you know, Heidi's blog or and also, you know, Newsarama and Comic Book Resources and iFanboy and all the ones that people read. But yeah, they need to get it out to the publishers' weekly people or the other major players in the publishing market or the digital market and make sure it's out there.
Well, one of the things I want to kind of be clear on, because I think people have a mistaken impression of my vantage point on this. Frankly, I would kind of love it if at some point in the future, be it a year from now, 2 years from now, or really whenever, even next month or whatever, that the industry got to the point where digital sales are so strong that really the print sales are almost that's icing on the cake. You know, we're solid. We've got the money. We can now go do what we want to do, and it's the gravy train is running again kind of a time.
Right.
I really have no vested interest in the print sales being really great or really bad or whatever. I'm talking about them because I'm interested in them, and I think right now it's still the driving force for content creation.
Mm-hmm.
There will come a point where that may not be the case. You know, there may not come that point, but I suspect sooner or later it probably will. Flip side, I thought that about trades too, and I've been woefully wrong on that.
Not the only one there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we've had talks a couple of years back where really I thought by this point in time, the seesaw would have flipped and it would have not been the comics that were the lion's share of the income, but really it would have been the trade side.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, DC topped the total unit sales for both the top 300 comics and the top 300 trades. And on the unit side, they made about 13.25 million, a little over that. On the trade side, they made about 1.5 million, and that's at full retail price. So obviously they didn't actually make that much.
Right.
But that's the value of the sales. Pretty big difference there, you know? So we're not at the point where the trades are the bread and butter of the publishing engine or whatever. And I really don't know at what point we'll hit that on the digital side. And of course, there is no way to know as an outsider, because that data is just not available.
Mm-hmm. Yes, maybe someday it will be available, you know?
I don't know, because I'm under the impression that some of these publishers and app people, like potentially Comixology themselves, may be contractually prevented from giving out that information.
Right.
At which point, I mean, they're the equivalent of Diamond to a degree. They would be the ones who would be able to provide us these sort of indexed lists. You know, so until that sort of a thing changes, and it won't change until there's a good business case.
Right.
You know, we may never know. But in the meanwhile, as long as we can go read comics, it's all good.
Mm-hmm.
So, top 300, we talked, DC had the largest share of the pie. By units, they had 23.68%. So not even a quarter. They did that with 61 total items on the list, 41 of which were reorder. But again, DC's always been kind of heavy on the reorder activity on the trade side. Marvel had a total of 48 items on the list. Only 9 were reorder, 39 were new. And they had about 21.43% of the total unit sales for the top 300. Because they tended to have a noticeably higher average cover price, they actually had a little over 27% of the dollars for the top 300 compared to the 26.21% for DC. So they made about, $45,000 cover price more than DC, give or take.
Yeah, it's pretty tight, isn't it? It's boy, you're splitting hairs right there.
Yeah, it's, that's part of what makes the trade side a bit more fun when looking at
right.
The breakdown of the top 300 is it's really anybody's game.
Right,
you know, it's not
or these two companies.
Well, but even so, I mean, Image isn't that far behind with the 10% of the units,
right?
The 9% of the dollars, a little over in each case. Granted, that equates to really about a third of the total dollar sales for either Marvel or DC, at about $500,000 versus the $1.5 million plus for DC and Marvel. But it's not so lopsided like the comic side. There also just tends to be a ton more publishers on the list.
Mm-hmm.
Not really seeing anything else that jumps out at me on the breakdown of the trades. You?
No, it's pretty cut and dry. You know, Image and then Dark Horse and then Viz and IDW. You know, it's kind of the same old breakdown.
Yeah.
The only thing that I would mention is you know, we've talked about the past couple months about bigger books going by the wayside.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the month that Marvel dropped their double slipcase Dark Tower omnibus on us for $125.
Yet it still wasn't the highest priced item on the list.
No, that's true. What was?
It was Humanoids.
The other one.
The Metabarons. Metabarons. Collection slipcase. Yes. $129.95 cover price, sold about 366 units.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a print run of like 700.
Yeah.
I think that's what they did with the Inkle. Yeah, but I think it's the Inkle went fast. That thing sold out in a New York minute. But then they did release it in a hardcover. And if you want to, you could always find it online and in different various places around the internet too.
Yeah. Yeah.
So talk about your digital piracy. That's one of the first ones that's ever was out there, John. That and the Complete Marvel Man.
Really? Yeah, right? I believe that.
Yeah.
Because the Marvel Man, really hard to get a hold of sometimes. It's hard to find.
No, not on your average BitTorrent site.
Well, but in print.
In print, yeah, that's what I'm talking. Same with the Metabarons. And, you know, the entire Metabarons. That's because for a long time that was hard to find in print. It would come out for publications here and a publication there and have to be translated from French into English, and it was very hard to find. But, I've seen the Metabarons in digital form, rather, you know, a PDF, for a number of years now.
Now, so, that $125 item for Marvel was the X-Men Claremont and Lee omnibus number one.
Oh, was that Claremont and Lee?
Yeah, down at rank 75.
Oh, then Dark Tower must come out in September then.
It may have.
Okay, the Claremont Lee. My bad. I should know better.
You should not.
I can't keep it straight.
Hey, at that price point, I don't even try.
Exactly. No,
I mean, this
yeah.
is... I mean, if they can get something like that out... see, last month it was the Thor Omnibus by Simonson at $125.
That came out in July.
Actually, that came out originally in April, but it placed on the list.
Oh, okay.
The other one that came out in September, I believe, was the Art of Marvel Studios slipcase at $150.
Oh, Jesus.
Those are some high-ticket items.
That's really high-ticket.
And the Dark Tower Omnibus, $150, came
that
out
was 150,
yeah, September.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, 723 units in September.
Jeez.
Those are some pretty hefty price tags.
Yeah, I skipped all those. I did get the Simonson Thor one, though.
But, you know, hey, if somebody's got the money and they really like the stuff, it's cool to have a really nice presentation of it.
Oh, sure.
I mean,
my big gripe with, and I said it years ago when Marvel was bringing out the Dark Tower books, and I picked them up not only for me, but I really picked them up for a friend of mine who was not into comics. But he isn't a Stephen King. And I still collect for him, actually. And, you know, I buy it and I read it and I hand it to my friend Mark and everything. But the thing is with the Dark Tower books is they've got some great prose stuff in the back of the monthly books.
Mm-hmm.
But when it came to collecting them, whether it be in their premier hardcover or trade, they left all the prose stuff out. And it really made up for a good 5 pages of the story. And now what they finally did is collect all that stuff in the second slipcase.
All right, the question I've got for you along those lines is mm-hmm. It used to be at one point when a trade or a hardcover would come out, they would have that bonus DVD extra type stuff.
Right.
Okay? But then it got to the point where they realized, well, gee, we're really incentivizing people to not get the monthly, to get the trade, and that's kind of killing the monthly sales, and that's bad for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So they started to put some of that stuff in the monthly stuff and not in the trades and the hardcovers. So at this point, excluding personal preference of, gee, it looks nicer on my bookshelf, or those sorts of personal preferences for format,
mm-hmm.
is there which format has the preferential treatment in terms of the DVD extra type stuff? Are we seeing that more on the collected edition? Are we seeing that more on the monthly periodical side, or are we just not seeing much of that at all?
I think it just depends on the title and the company, because as I was collecting the Project Superpowers over at Dynamite. They had a ton of Alex Ross stuff in the back of their books, in the monthly side.
Yeah.
And I really liked their, you know, the charcoal or the pencil sketches of what was going on and the different looks and the Golden Age characters and the breakdown of actually who these characters are in our modern era nowadays, right? And I thought that was really fun. And as far as I know, they did collect all that in the trade side as well, too. So, you know, they didn't have to collect it, but they did, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what Marvel chose not to do as it came to the Dark Tower.
Interesting.
So, you know, it's, you know, maybe that's something that I kind of figured that DC would do with the new look, with the number ones and the new 52, having a lot more bonus material, and maybe we will see that when the absolute new 52 comes out in December. I'm very eager to see what extras we're going to get in this book.
What we're getting now is that 5.2 question kind of mini interview thing on
yeah.
a couple of them, which. Interesting use of a house ad to kind of do a mini interview, whatever. I've got mixed feelings on those.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other thing that was at the high end of the price point this time around, we've got the Absolute Identity Crisis at rank 69, 1,141 estimated units. I believe that's new in October.
That was new, yeah.
We also have the Absolute All-Star Superman with some reorder activity of 450 units down around rank, I think, 203, putting its total reported estimated sales just shy of 2,600. The Wolverine Omnibus by Jason Aaron, Volume 1, again, $99.99 really for all three of those.
Mm-hmm.
That one's at rank 149 at about 619 estimated units. And really, for items at those price points, that's not bad.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about the Meta Barons, the X-Men and Claremont. The only other thing at the $75 or over is actually a penny under, but I'm going to count it anyways. That's the Definitive Irredeemable Volume 1 hardcover from Boom, which originally came out in July. It's got some, I believe, reorder activity. No, actually... It was originally supposed to come out in June.
It was supposed to come out for Comic-Con. It never did.
It came out at the beginning of October, 14 weeks late. Shame on you, Boom.
Mm-hmm.
For 313 units. Now, I don't know if that's a slipcase or whatever. I'm enjoying Irredeemable quite a bit.
I think it is a slipcase, yeah.
But it's interesting. That's probably more high-ticket items than we've really seen for a while.
Well, and we're going to get a lot of reorder activity with the... like the Dark Knight, they're all getting reissued in late November, early December. The Absolutes, like the Sandman ones, are all coming out again and everything. So I think we're going to see a lot more reorder activity on that stuff as they got resolicited a few months ago. Yeah.
And really, I think it's a good move because I think we had a pretty good summer of comic book-related movies. Mm-hmm. The new 52 is getting people thinking about comics. So it may make some really good gift-giving items for the holiday season.
Yeah, not only that, the fifth Sandman Absolute is coming out.
That would do it too, yeah.
In fact, you know what? It is already out. It came out last week, I believe, or 2 weeks ago. So,
cool.
I have that one on order.
Now, topping the list this time around was Flashpoint, and as I mentioned, it did 5,646 estimated units. And... man, it's really a kind of a low top of the list. Not the lowest we've seen, but given that Flashpoint has kind of rebooted the DC universe, I would have expected that to have done a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
Rank number two, we got Walking Dead Volume 7 hardcover, 4,674 estimated units, followed by Batman Arkham City hardcover with 4,310 units. Now, that's original to hardcover, correct?
It's tying into the video game, though.
That's what I thought, yeah. Mm-hmm. But sometimes the original to hardcover will do a little bit better than average because they couldn't get it already on the monthly side. And then we've got Unwritten Volume 4 trade paperback at 4,144 units in rank 4. And those are the only things that did above 4,000 units.
Yeah.
And we only have one thing beyond that that did above 3,500 units, and that's the Star Wars Clone Wars Strange Allies trade paperback that did 3,520 units.
Good month for DC, you know, just looking at the top 10.
Yeah, yeah. I think part of it is they've got a really strong trade side. It's rare for them to have a really bad month. Now, granted, it wasn't a really strong month for some of the other publishers. This was also correspondingly not a huge month for DC on the trade side. And it's interesting. I did a comparison of how Marvel, DC, and kind of the other publishers in mass did compared to the last, you know, year, again, October of last year to September of this year. And this month of October, Marvel was down almost 25% from their average.
Mm-hmm.
DC was down a little under 20% from their average. Everybody else was down only about 1% from average. And in total, everything was kind of down a little under 12% from that average for the last year.
What was the number one book last year?
Do you have that in front of you? I do not have that in front of me. I was just looking at aggregates.
Oh, okay. I was just wondering. I was wondering if it was like Walking Dead Volume 6 or something like that, or 5.
It's whatever placed top in July. I'm willing to bet that would have been a Walking Dead. Give me a sec. I'll pop it open and take
I'm just kind of curious. If we're comparing month to month or year to year, it's kind of fun to look back and, you know, like this date in history kind of stuff. So
League of Extraordinary Gentlemen 3, Century Number 2, 1969.
Ah, okay.
That's a long title.
Which was a $7.99 comic book.
$9.95 actually.
Was it $9.95?
Still under $10, so does it really count?
What was 2?
I would have to go dig around a bit for that.
Oh, okay.
It was easy to take a look at what was the top ranked for that last year and pull it up. I'm going to guess the number 2 is what ranked top in June, which was Walking Dead Volume 14.
Okay, there you go.
Trade paperback with over 20,000 units.
Okay.
So, it's it's interesting because, you know, we've had the top of the trade list go as high as nearly 44,000 units once. Mm-hmm. Again, it's averaging a little over that 11,000, a little under 11,500. And I mean, some months were just a far cry from that. Other months were pretty much dead on. This was one of the lower points that the bottom of the list has hit, not the lowest, but the bottom of the list was 284 units, whereas the low point is 251. And that low item this time was some reorder activity on The Boys Volume 7 trade paperback. But, I mean, there are a lot of things near the lower part of the list here, at the bottom part, that if you do enough reorder activity, it's really not that big of a deal to just move a few hundred units.
Mm-hmm.
We got the first volume of Atomic Robo at rank 291, moving another 294 estimated units, putting it close to 4,000 units for its total known sales. Irredeemable Volume 1 trade paperback at rank 284 did around 305 estimated units. It's starting to close in on 15,000 units at 14,723. DMZ Volume 1 at rank 278. It's like the 28th time it's been seen on the list, or it's been seen 28 times before.
Mm-hmm.
It's 312 units of reorder activity. Puts its known reported sales to 19,706 units. And I'll stress that's total reported estimated sales. DMZ is one of those titles that typically goes and does some activity below the bottom of the list, and consistently enough that it usually does surprisingly well when you compare the year-end top list, because, I mean, Diamond's gotten to where they report a few thousand items or whatever on there. And if you just tally up what the top 300 had done for the 12 months, the DMZ stuff tends to place higher than the aggregated list of the top 300s. You know, it's under the radar sales, but consistently so. And there is a lot to be said for that kind of slow and steady sales, you know, path or whatever. Because it's great to do gangbusters 1 month, but it's even better to do, you know, a couple hundred units month in, month out, forever.
Mm-hmm.
Another one that's going along those lines is the first volume of the Unwritten trade paperback, 331 units. It ranked 263, putting its total reported sales at 12,128 units. We've seen Superman Earth 1 hardcover on the list 10 times before. The 335 items or units of reorder activity puts its total sales around 37,117 units, which is still a far cry below where the Superman Grounded storyline had been doing, I believe. Yet people love this a lot more, you know. And of course, this was selling in the direct the mass market, whereas the monthly comics were doing so, but not to any noticeable degree comparatively. So it's interesting because we're at about the time of year where some of the Marvel comics are starting to do the statement of ownership. And I've got only a handful of them so far. I was thinking I might talk about this next month with Bob.
Yeah.
But if we look at... Let's see, we've got X-Men, Uncanny X-Men, Hulk, and Amazing Spider-Man. Pick one of those. Which do you want to see the print runs for?
Say those again?
X-Men, Uncanny X-Men, Hulk, and Amazing Spider-Man.
Oh, Amazing Spider-Man.
Yeah, that's kind of what I figured. Bob probably want to know that one, too.
Right.
I haven't had time to really kind of crunch these numbers, but if you go in that comic to the staple and flip one page past that, on the right side, there's a house ad for Avengers Academy number 23. Big deal. Who cares? But on the right side of that, for about a third of the page, is the statement of ownership.
Okay.
Now, this is where they're required by the Postal Service to put in information about how is the book doing. Okay. Now, in this case, again, we're looking at Amazing Spider-Man, so pardon me for just a second as I flip to the comic book list and filter that down to just Amazing Spider-Man so I can have a point of comparison.
Alrighty.
671, according to my list through Diamond, did around 59,426 units. 672 did around 57,860 units. So we'll average just those two together, and we're talking around 58,600-ish. Now, the last, the filing date of this was September 30th, and some of these numbers are averages, some of these are last one kind of released or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, total number of copies printed, which is the net print run, for the average issue was... 79,844.
Okay.
Most recent issue was 94,256, which is actually a fair degree higher than those estimated sales I've got. Actually, surprisingly so.
Yeah, when you said the 59,000, I'm like, well, that seems low for a Spider-Man title, but it is what it is.
Now, that is on item 15 of this. If you go to, or 15A, if you go to 15C... which is the sum of 15B1 and 15B3, you get the total paid and or requested circulation. And the average number of copies each issue during the preceding 12 months, 70,418. Actual number of copies of the single issue published nearest to the filing date, 79,251. Now, what you'll notice is there's about a 15,000 unit difference on the single issue published nearest the filing date, and about a... 9,000 unit difference between the print run and the paid circulation. What's interesting is the free distribution by mail is reported as zero outside the mail, 794 copies on average, 768 nearest the filing date. The bottom line, what this tells us, is that total distribution, 15G, average for the 12 months, 71,212. Most recent, 80,019. So really, we're only talking, we're talking, about 20,000 units almost, 20,000 units, between how Diamond is doing and how things are doing outside of it. But still, the lion's share by a pretty wide margin is happening through Diamond.
Mm-hmm.
Historically, that's usually been the case. There have been times it's been as much as, you know, closing in on 90%. And it varies from title to title. It varies from year to year. Part of it depends, you know, what do they consider closest to the filing date versus what really was, you know, what am I guessing that they picked? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that was just for the two issues of Amazing Spider-Man that shipped in October, which actually was after the filing date. I would need to pull up the prior month and compare to that, which I should have done. Give me just a minute to go pull those numbers up. The fun and excitement. And what we get there is actually the issue that was expected to ship on September 14th was 669. It did 71,944 units. 928, the issue for that week was 670, and it did 57,599 units. Actually, I'm back a month, that's why. I'm getting confused between what I was thinking for October versus September, which is why I don't usually compare months like this. And that 71,000 and stuff, that's actually a lot closer to what the numbers we were looking at there. So still, there's a difference, but the sales through Diamond really matter.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly when you compare to the full print run and stuff of some of these books. It's a fairly manual task to dig through the statement of ownership, pull all that data out, get it into a crunchable format. If I have a chance, I will try to do that for next month. On the comic side, we may talk about it some too, but no promises on that.
This is something DC doesn't advertise?
It's not advertising, technically. It is a requirement of the Postal Service, and DC, being no fool, I'm going to say 30 years ago, maybe, shifted to second-class postage or
okay,
whatever, and this is only required for first class. I would, I'd have to refresh my memory and do a little research to figure out the exact rules of it and stuff.
All right.
But DC basically changed how they sent out their subscriptions to not be required to do this.
Huh.
And, you know, it makes sense to do that.
I wonder why Marvel's still first class.
Apparently it wasn't worth the hassle to change it, or they farmed it out to a third party that doesn't want to change it. I don't know.
They could, yeah.
I mean, there's a ton of reasons.
Hmm.
I'm trying to see if there is a number here of paid copies through the mail, and I am not seeing that. Sales through dealers, carriers, street vendors, and counter sales. Average number during the preceding 12 months, 64,768. Actual closest to the filing date, 73,344. Paid or requested mail subscriptions. The average is 5,650. Actual for most recent issue, 5,907.
Okay.
So they've got 5,000-6,000 subscribers through the mail. And depending how much it would cost them per person to shift how they ship it out to avoid having to give this information. But this is something that, particularly the print runs and stuff like that, really show how over the years comics have gotten a lot more efficient in the number of copies they print versus sell. And how the direct market, you know, became a bigger and bigger part of the picture and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. They also listed as thrice monthly, whereas I believe it's gotten down to just bi-monthly.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one of the outside sources I try to compare every year, just to make sure that the numbers I've got are kind of, you know, in line with how many copies they're printing and stuff. I mean, obviously, if the percentages were way out of whack, you know, and it's like, well, Diamond's reporting them selling, you know, twice what they're printing. It's like, something's not right there.
Yeah, I don't think we've ever talked about this before.
Have we not?
No.
I thought I've just brought it up on the comic book side.
Yeah. Huh.
Again, I find this very interesting because these are the few hard numbers that that Marvel is by law, or not by law, but by postal requirements, which you could argue is law or not, I guess,
right,
required to publish.
Hmm.
And DC, you know, again, has changed their business practice long since. Again, this goes back to late 70s, early 80s. If you go far enough back in the DC stuff, you'll get the statement of ownerships. And it's interesting to look at. you know, it's a little hard to interpret sometimes because they've changed the format a little over the years. So making sure that you're comparing apples to apples from year to year is not always trivial. But because I've got to basically scan these in and then go manually key this stuff in, it's not like an automated part of my number crunching system.
No.
Now, if somebody listening knows where I can get this digitally and just pump it into my database, please let me know. I would love to have that information, because that would give a very interesting picture. You know, using Marvel as a benchmark, how is the direct market doing kind of overall? Now, there's no reason to think DC's selling along the same lines as the Marvel titles, etc., but I deal with the data I can get my hands on. You know, and that's, in this case, the sales statement of ownership stuff is not strictly Marvel, but out of the stuff I get, predominantly Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the independent publishers don't put those in. Presumably they don't have the same sort of subscription setup. The one publisher that does put them in, but I don't read enough, really much of, if any of, is Archie. And those are always interesting to look at because, man, sometimes they're doing print runs of, you know, 250,000 units or whatever,
right,
and selling the majority. So, I mean, it's always a good reminder that the direct market is not the be-all, end-all of comic book sales, just within print. Obviously, now we've got the digital stuff. But it is still the driving force.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, the monthly comics or the periodical comics are the driving force of content creation. Well, it's all nice and good how these things are selling as the trades, and that certainly influences the publishers as to what they keep, what they get rid of. The cash flow, for the most part, is happening on the monthly comic side. You know, that's what's paying for the content creation to where they can compile these into trade and be making profits on them later. But, man, I don't think they could do their bread and butter and, you know, cash flow and stuff through just the trade side.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, like I said earlier, I think it'll be a while before it happens to where it could be on the digital side. Be happy to be wrong on that. If publishers can find a viable revenue stream that just works for them, I think that's awesome.
Yeah, but we talked in the beginning of the show. We've been talking for years about when is the periodical going to go away, and it's going to go all the trades, and it just isn't going to happen overnight. It is going to take a couple more years, if ever, you know.
Well, and I think that if ever is a good thing, because I don't want anyone listening to think that I'm suggesting that the monthly comic is just going to go away, like the vinyl record album kind of,
right,
sort of has, but not, technically is still around, but is so much more of a niche item now.
Right.
DJs are about the only guys to go hunt those down. But with the comic side, the sales, certainly less so for DC right now, but by and large have been slumping across the board.
Mm-hmm.
Again, there's what, four items at Marvel that did over 60,000 units in October. And that's not because DC was doing gangbusters. It's because Marvel didn't really have anything other than the few we mentioned that were, I don't say worthy of doing more than that, but you know what I mean. It was,
right,
a reflection of what they had versus a reflection of what somebody else had.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that is going to really come into play on the digital side more so than on the trade of the monthly is the return on investment. When you plunk down your digital money and get your digital comic, you read through it, do you feel you spent enough time and got enough story? And I'm going to pick on DC with the new 52, and I'm going to say that's one of the weak points of their lineup.
But there's more to it than just getting story. I think with digital, it's convenience of taking a lot with you on one single device.
I completely concede that, but I think that is more for hardcore people like us,
yeah,
than casual readers. Casual readers are going to be very much, I paid $2.99, I read for 10 minutes maybe, and I got the middle part of a story.
Mm-hmm.
Is that story so gripping, are those 20 pages so great, they're going to drop down another $2.99 for the next issue? Or even wait a month and do them $1.99 or whatever. Maybe for a lot of people it will be, but for my perspective, were I not a hardcore comic fan, and to a degree, I don't want to say going out of inertia, but I mean that's almost a factor. Out of the New 52, Superman is the one that I felt really gave me my money's worth and return on that investment in the single issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's why I think we see, I don't want to say better sales on the trade side, because we don't see better sales, but we see fairly consistent sales. We see fairly regular sales. We don't see kind of that huge drop-off that we see on the monthly side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now it may take some volumes a little longer to get up there. Some titles may not get up to the same levels or whatever, but, you know, you look at... I think you see basically a flatter sales trend. Some titles just don't drop that much. Some go up, but not as much, you know. And you compare those, the units between the trade and the, and by trade, I mean both the hardcover, the trade, all that kind of stuff, and the component issues in it. It's frequently almost like a 10 to 1 difference or whatever. I mean, you look at that Flashpoint hardcover, compare that to how the sales have been doing, and it was topping, or not necessarily the top, but near the top of the list when it was coming out. And there's a easily 10 to 1, if not a 20 to 1 difference in sales there.
Well, that's where I think the responsibility is coming on the publisher, like DC or Marvel or whoever else, and not just listing the monthly periodical, you know, Spider-Man, you know, 666 or Spider-Man 667, 668, 669, 670, and 71, they really have to market it as the story arc, and that is what you're paying for.
Well, I think on the trade side or the collected side, yes. On the monthly side, they need to get away from the story arc and get back to the never-ending saga feeling.
Yeah, that's like in the 70s, right.
Yeah. The example I go to on this is Lost.
Mm-hmm.
Lost did gangbusters. Sure, it had some dry spells here and there, second or third season maybe. But for me, fifth season of Lost, one of the best seasons of television I'd watched. And it was one of those where every episode, wow, I can't wait till the next one. I got a full story. They ended on a strong note. Wow, what's going to happen next?
Right.
What's going to happen next? And there were little arcs here and there and stuff through it, but not one of those where I felt I'd watched six issues and there was a chapter break or whatever kind of a deal. And you look at the monthly comics, and they're very clearly written. This is a first issue. This is a middle issue. This is the final issue. End of story. Tie things up pretty much in a bow so we can start the clean on the next issue. You know, now, whether it's going to be to that point with the New 52, too early to tell. But traditionally, that's how it has been. I look at the new Superman title that Perez is doing, and every issue feels like it's got a beginning, middle, and an end, ends on the end resolution, but a sense of closure enough to say, okay, I finished this part of this story, this chapter, but it's a very full, meaty chapter, not the middle
part. Oh, yeah,
part,
that's for sure.
You know, yeah.
You're getting your money's worth with them.
Yeah, but some of these others, it feels like they're going from cliffhanger to cliffhanger, just marking time.
Right.
Until that changes, I really don't know how sticky the sales are going to be or the content's going to be on the digital side. You know, it should be something that people are anxiously awaiting that next issue. They should be able at the end of the issue to have a click here to email me the instant that next issue is available. And frankly, right now, I don't know if a lot of people, and maybe it's just I have high expectations on the comic side, if such an option were available, I don't know how many people would check that on most books.
Right.
One of the things people say about Walking Dead and I think Fables, which is part of why they do so well on the trade list, is once you get into that story, it just pulls you along. You want to get that next installment. And the solve, the solution, the answer to the sales conundrum that the comics have typically been in over the last couple of years comes down to editorial content. Telling stories that sell themselves and that sell that next issue. And not in a cheap cliffhanger kind of a way of, oh, how will he survive this? But wow, this is a really good story that ended on a very provocative thought, you know, gee, where are they going to go next moment? I want to see where they go.
But, you know, slowly we are getting that. just looking on the list, looking at Brian Azzarello's Joker, that's been on the list for a long time. Superman Earth 1 has been out for a while now. That's got legs on it.
Both of which were original to the collected edition, correct?
Right, that's what I'm talking about, yeah. So I think that we are going to see more and more of these, you know, one-and-done stories, you know, 72 pages or whatever it is. Which I welcome that change.
I would welcome that too, but I disagree that we're going to see more of that. Things like Batman Arkham City and those other ones you cited are few and far between.
Yeah, well, they're too far. No, I agree with that. Yeah,
they
too
used
far.
To be more common.
Right. Oh, yeah. I remember the Punisher ones were great, you know.
You know, back when we got the JLA Earth 2.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
those
that's
sorts
a great
of things
story.
Would come out at least once a year.
Mm-hmm.
But now, even some of the other things that have kind of, I don't want to say pioneered the format, but really moved forward in that, you know, it seems like it's been a little while since I've seen a solicit or a new issue of Empowered from Dark Horse, which was original to the trade paperback, kind of a manga style to it. Likewise, there was Brody's Ghost, which was an 80-page thing by Mark Crilly, who was behind Akiko. I forget which publisher that was, but I mean, that was some great stuff. Again, original to that larger format. The majority of the items on this list have been, and for quite some time, I think always will be, collected edition of other material.
Mm-hmm.
Be it translated material for the manga side or just compiled stuff on the American side. Or the English side, I should say. Some of this is not just American. I really think, though, that with the digital platform, we may be seeing the concept of the trade paperback get downplayed. Certainly, it doesn't make sense digitally. You just go get those couple issues. Maybe it's a bundle, but it's not a separate orderable item necessarily. You know, might as well give the people the different covers and stuff of the individual issues. So since you're not binding it differently, you know, it takes on a very different connotation, I think, digitally than it does in print. You certainly don't have the hardcover-softcover duality digitally, so that gets rid of a certain degree of double-dipping, and really I think the double-dipping thing almost goes away as digitally. It's not like I've got the monthlies, but I think the hardcover or trade would look better on my bookcase. They're all sitting in my iPad, my Google tablet, or whatever device you've got. Digitally, they all look kind of the same. So,
well, that's where I think the publishers could be a little more creative with their digital stuff. I mean, I've touched on this before when I was at the Fort Wayne Comic Book Show. They had the digital panel, and a question was brought up about what can publishers do differently? And the guy said, "Hey, you download my book, the full book, and you know, with it, you'll get a digital podcast of me talking about the creative process and kind of like a read along, like a director's cut, where how you listen to the director's commentary on something. That would be very interesting to have." So they just have to be a little more creative. That's all.
Well, and I think those are, I think you've nailed it right on the head right there.
Yeah,
because that's something where
I would pay for that.
Oh yeah, if I could get a digital download of JLA Avengers with one commentary track by Kurt Busiek walking me through the story, another one by George Perez walking me through the art, oh man, I would be all over that.
Yeah, that would be cool.
And probably willing to pay a pretty penny.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Now, would I do that for everything? Certainly not. But for the equivalent of an Absolute or an Omnibus or some of those high-ticket items, that would be the digital equivalent of that.
Right, exactly.
And frankly, if they were smart, they would have that something that you could buy the monthly and kind of upgrade, if you will, later.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a lot of potential, a lot of options that the digital market could go in to really differentiate it from the trade hardcover side of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would be good, because what we've seen is the trade hardcover really decimated the back issue market and then started eating into the new issue market. We have not seen that kind of cannibalism yet with the digital side, although some people, I mean, I was talking to one guy at the Austin Comic Con this past weekend. He's getting stuff, he's read more digitally than he has in print.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is a guy who's been around the industry for quite some time. It was actually Kevin McGuire. And his point was basically 2 in the morning, he decides he wants to read something, bam, he can get it right then and there.
Yeah, true.
Cannot argue that kind of convenience. But if it can, if the format can really differentiate itself, stand on its own, and become the modern day equivalent of the spinner rack, which was an entry point for so many people at one point into comic books, that could really turn things around big picture wise for the comic industry.
That's what we need. We need a photograph of a spinner rack full of iPads.
That would be funny.
That would be cool. Somebody get on that.
Yeah. I'll see what I can do.
That would be kind of funny.
Yeah.
And God bless Kevin Maguire for waking up at 2 in the morning, you know, flipping on his tablet and buying something, because I am dead asleep at 2 in the morning.
Yeah.
And so are you.
Oh, yeah.
I know you too well.
But Maguire, man, that guy's got some energy. He's a great guy. He was a lot of fun to talk with.
We'll talk a little bit about that, about your panel that you did, real quick.
Yeah, this was the second Wizard World Austin here in town. And I, of course, with the podcast, got a press badge to get in. They asked if they mentioned they still needed moderators for 2 panels. Both of them were breaking into comics. One was on Saturday, one was on Sunday. I looked at the list of artists, and I said, you know, I really don't know that first group, but that second group, I'm familiar with a lot of their work. And it was going to be Kevin Maguire, Patrick Gleason, and Freddie Williams. Patrick Gleason couldn't make the convention, unfortunately, so it was just those two. Kevin Maguire, who broke in back in, I think he said, 86, his first published stuff in 88, and Freddie Williams, who got in the industry around 2005. So a little bit of a time difference there. With Kevin Maguire, who I think is just one of the just an amazingly talented artist, to me, the hallmark of his art is just the expressiveness, the acting in it. And man, just talking with him while I was moderating the panel and stuff, I could really see where all of that came from, because he has done improv comedy. He likes doing that kind of stuff, and he very much thinks along the lines of an actor, and he is doing the acting, he is doing the camera placement, he's doing all of that in his art. And they were talking at one point, the discussion was basically, you know, how do you like the scripts? And he was saying he preferred full dialogue, because there have been times where he would get the plot, he would draw the stuff, somebody else would then dialogue it, and he'd look at it and say, well, if I know they were going to say that, I would not have drawn that. I'd have drawn, you know, whatever. Which, if you think about it, makes sense. Imagine watching a sitcom where it was like all voiceover or whatever, and the guy being filmed didn't know what the voiceover was going to be. It might not match too well. But Maguire was also one of those, he's the kind of guy that's just really good kind of instinctively and hasn't really dissected his craft.
Right.
Doesn't need to. He's a damn good artist. Jeez. Freddie Williams, on the other hand, is much more cognizant of how he does what he does. He's written a book on digital art for DC Comics and stuff. The how-to guide or whatever. It's a great book. Great book. But I would go and I would ask questions about this, that, or the other. And I would get a really funny, you know, answer from Kevin Maguire. And I'd get a really detailed kind of a, I don't say by the numbers, but a very much more process-oriented, thoughtful from Freddie Williams. I mean, it was like two ends of the spectrum. It was really a lot of fun. It was great. Both of those are wonderful guys, very talented artists. They just approach their stuff very similar in some respects and very differently in other respects. And I thought that was just fascinating.
Yeah, you didn't have to do an audio on that, did you?
I tried, but I seem to have botched the recording.
Oh, that would have been good.
Yeah, that would have been good. first panel I've moderated, I certainly think I could have done better, but I don't think I did too badly.
No, you're fine, I'm sure.
So it was definitely fun, and the convention was much bigger than it was last year. The nice thing is this year the panels were actually in different rooms. Huge, huge difference. Massive improvement that way. Before, they were both in this big room with just curtains between them. So you're right. In one panel listening to the other panel. It was kind of distracting.
That's what we had at the fanfare. It was really, really poorly done.
Yeah. But they had a lot of exhibitors. Huge, huge artist alley. I mean, it was half the size of the one in San Diego, if not bigger.
Really? That's pretty big.
It was massive. And then they had the celebrity guests, of course, quite a few people there.
Right.
So all in all, it was a great show. I really hope they're able to keep doing it here in town. Certainly go back to it again and again.
What'd you buy? Anything good?
I bought very little.
Did you?
Yeah. Part of that is I really wasn't in the mood to go digging through back issue bins, quite a few of which were not sorted. But, you know, I get enough monthly stuff that I really don't typically need to go back issue diving.
Right.
One of the guys in Artist Alley, Jeff D., did the art in some of the old TSR stuff. He did Villains of Vigilantes, the role-playing game, which is the first superhero role-playing game. And he had a couple of the modules there. It's like, okay, I'll take them.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
So I spent a couple of bucks on that. That was fun. That was really most of the shopping I did. Daz Studios was there. They do 3D art tools with Daz Studio. And, man, that was really tempting to pick that up. Amazing, amazing tool set. And the main reason I didn't is I just don't think I'd have time to actually play around and use it yet. At some point when I can kind of clear off a little more time on a regular basis, that's something I probably will pick up and play with. It just looks like fun. I used to play with Poser back in the day. This was 10, 15 years ago. When I, you know, had a little more free time, there were fewer comics coming out. I wasn't doing the podcasting, all that kind of stuff.
Right, right.
Amazing how much time that opens up. And what they were showing me with the Daz Studio, just it looked really intuitive. It was a very slick program, very cool stuff. Because at some point I would like to do a comic book, and I think, you know, from my standpoint, I really think the future of comic book art, not for everything, but for a certain segment, is computer generated.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah.
To where you could do it kind of like the old animation studios, where it's like, okay, this is, you have somebody do the breakdowns, essentially farm it out, get it all back pretty quick. It would allow you to do more story more consistently, faster.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for me, the difference is, compared to the photo-generated comics we've seen in a couple of cases, which I think are wonderful, I love those, I want something that looks like a traditional comic book. Not going to say you would confuse it with like a George Perez or something.
Right.
But maybe a Kevin Maguire, maybe an Ivan Rice, maybe a... who's the artist on Green Arrow these days? Oh, shoot, I'm blanking.
Not Krull.
Not Dan Jurgens. No. It's but, you know, nice, clean style like that.
Right, yeah.
You know how the Udon Studio stuff looks?
Oh, sure.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Something towards a nice, clean... style and stuff, but very much traditional comic book looking art. For all I know, the Udon Studios maybe does computer generated art. Don't know. that's personally where my art tastes lie, and having something where you could then say, you know, hey, that's great, but I want to see the scene from the other character's perspective, or some of that kind of stuff, or what if you move the camera up? Things like that. I find that interesting. So. There was that, and of course the fact that the convention was the same weekend as the previews teleconference, recording of the previews spotlight episodes, and all that, because we're actually recording this about a week and a half before it's going to go up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a busy week or so for me, because it was only a week ago that these numbers first came out, so doing that, recording a handful of episodes, the convention, editing the podcast and stuff, plus reading a ton of comics. It's been busy for me. So, how about you? What's going on with you?
You know, not a whole lot. You know, just, you know, I've been trying to catch up on my reading, you know, which I haven't really been. I've really been trying to catch up on my website, on the CCL website, because there's just so much going on there with the library section and the release schedule every Monday that I've got to work on. And usually when I record with you on Mondays, I do it on Tuesdays. And usually, you know, even sometimes Wednesdays, you know, but that seems to be very, you know, a very busy part of my site, which I like. And, you know, people have asked me if I wanted to charge for it. And I'm like, no, you know, it's all free. It's all public information from Diamond and Comic List over at Charlie's site anyway. So I don't want to charge for anything. It's kind of silly. But no, I mean, the website's good. I'm not doing as much reviews as I have been, but that's because work has been very busy, which I am thankful for that. But I just did a great interview with Richard Graham. And, John, you would love this book. Richard put together, along with the University of Nebraska, the University of Nebraska, it was very interesting. Is Richard happened to be at the right place at the right time, right? He's a comic book guy. He loves history, and he wanted to do he explains it on the interview that I did about how he got this project done. And he has a new book out called Government Issue. And these are all government PSAs from over the years, which are fascinating look into history. And it, just the artists and the writers who were involved in these, you know, old PSAs from the 1940s all the way up through today. They're still cranking them out. You know, whether it be, you know, the old duck and cover with nuclear war in the 1950s to Nancy Reagan's Say No to Drug campaign with the Teen Titans. You know, it's very just fascinating stuff. And, you know, Captain America going after drug dealers and everything. But it turns out the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, this is where they curate everything. For some reason, it all goes to Nebraska, right? So he went down in the this dingy old library that nobody has been in for decades, and he's digging up all these old PSAs, and just his story about going down there and finding, you know, booze and clothes and porno magazines, you know, lying around on the floor. And not only that, but these comics that were sitting out, a lot of them were put away, but some of them were sitting out in books, just literally collecting an inch worth of dust.
Wow.
And he found it all and he cleaned it up. And he's there's, you know, he has this one volume out, right? John, he could have out, you know, 20 volumes of everything. And thankfully, he's digitized these all. And a lot of it is on, he's got a website through the University of Nebraska. Then he put it up through the Abrams publisher. But if you like history, this is great stuff. I mean, really, really great stuff. And it's funny, we were talking about how, you know, you take something like these old scrapbook newspaper stuff, right? And you'd have to, when you throw them into a really high intensity, high resolution scanner, you are literally going to ruin whatever the paper you put in there.
Yeah.
Right. Which to me, it seemed fine to do so, because these have been sitting down in a basement for 30, 40, 50, 60 years. Right. So no one's looking at them anyway. So they're getting destroyed by time. So if you're going to destroy something by time, you're better off destroying it by a digital scanner so you can preserve it for the next generation.
Well, it's like the old, what was the process? I'm trying to remember how to pronounce it. Thinkinizing it or...
Thixenizing. Okay.
That's the one. Thixenizing it. I knew I was off on the pronunciation. Where they would essentially destroy some Golden Age books to where they could put together essentially some of the early, what was it, the archives at DC?
Yeah.
And, I mean, that was before the scanners we have today and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, on the one hand, it's a crime to destroy some of those old books. But on the other hand, it opened up that material to a whole new audience.
Right.
You know, and that's really, I think, not a bad trade-off.
Right.
You know, and that's going to be one of the other things with the digital era that's going to be, not immediately, but long-term. I'm talking like 50, 20, you know, 50, 75, 100 years out. All of this stuff potentially is still going to be floating around whatever the equivalent of the internet is at that point.
Right.
We're not going to have the issue that the Honeymooners had or Doctor Who has, where some episodes are just lost for all time.
Yeah, the old Johnny Carson. Just gone. Right.
I mean, it's less of an issue, I think, with comics, but even right now, it's hard to find a couple of old issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now, certain stuff, anybody could get it at any time.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be that way forever, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, and part of me, you know, for a guy who collects the archives and Masterworks, you know, part of me wants all this stuff out digitally so we can just have it. We've talked about this before.
Yeah.
but you know, and it'll get there. I'm not, you know, it might take a generation for Marvel and DC to get everything out in print form first, and then after that, you, whatever internet we have 20, 30 years from now, there's going to be absolutely no reason to reprint, you know, Superman 200 in a paper format. There just won't be.
It does put an increased priority, I think, on proper indexing and cataloging of aspects of comics.
Mm-hmm.
On the previews call this month, somebody was asking if the collection for the Flash that they had in previews had the beginning of the Speed Force. And it's like, well, I don't know. I thought that was a Mark Waid. We determined later it didn't, mm-hmm. and where to go get it. It's actually the Terminal Velocity storyline.
Oh, okay.
But we had to go hunt around on the internet a couple of places, and we tried Wikipedia for the Speed Force, a couple of Flash sites, whatever. And it was surprisingly hard to find out where the Speed Force really originated in the Flash comic book lore. Whereas, imagine if you could actually, in the span of a shopping expedition over at Comixology or wherever, pick up whatever issue of the Flash you want, and that's the issue you want. Well, great. Which issue is that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's going to put things like those indexes that Marvel's coming out with right now. Really, at some point, I think that's going to become the metadata behind a really powerful, really cool digital comics, you know, shopping cart engine.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, great, I've read this. Where's the next time this character appears?
Yeah, you know, sites like ComicBookDB and Comics.org, you know, are doing that. But, yeah, you really need to combine a ComicsDB with a Wikipedia with the main Marvel site. You know what I mean? To get them all collectively together.
Yes.
And, you know, because how many times do you go to do a search for Star Trek, right? And something, what's the first thing that pops up? When you do a Google search, it's Wikipedia. Where's the better place to go? Memory Alpha. You know what I mean? And it's in Memory Alpha, and it's not StarTrek.com. But yet, if you combine them all, well, then you're going to have all the information you need.
Well,
and that's what the next, I think, what maybe the next internet will be.
There's the old saying of a guy with a clock knows what time it is. A guy with two clocks is never quite sure.
Yeah.
So we've kind of hit that with the internet. There's a lot of places, sometimes conflicting information.
Right.
You know, so.
And it's so opinionated, too.
Yeah.
You know, that's the other thing. You got to filter everything out. I mean, that's why, you know, you can go to Twitter or Facebook for your breaking news, but you know, at the end of the day, maybe you're just better off turning on your TV at 6 o'clock. You know,
there comes a point where doing the research yourself in some cases is not a bad idea either.
Yeah,
that's
true.
Part of why I put the estimated sales up on comic book resources and stuff,
mm-hmm.
in addition to the analysis, is somebody can go look at it and say, but I disagree.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases that's great. In other cases, I question if they're really right or not. I mean, I'll admit there are times I can be completely wrong, but I've also been looking at these numbers for quite a while and have the context, the background on some of this stuff,
mm-hmm.
where somebody just looking at it can make some easy mistakes. But it's the type of thing, though. The data is out there on a lot of things, and knowing what data is available, where it is, and what's not available, so you don't waste time looking for it. That's going to be a increasingly important skill set going forward in time.
Well, that's one thing we talk about this month to month for years now, and ultimately what we want is how many issues of Batman sold. You know, how many out there, how many people actually plunk down their money, you know, and a lot of this is coming through Diamond. We don't know where it's going through the other models, but you know, we always do it at the end of the year. You try to guesstimate book scan and everything else, and you know, with the digital, more and more, like it or not, more and more people are going to digital, you know.
Oh, totally,
and,
totally.
And that's the information that we want, you know, ultimately, is to how many issues were sold, whether it be in the direct market or the digital market or whatever.
I actually would quibble with the phrasing on that just a hair.
Yeah.
I want to know how many were consumed.
Yeah, or consumed, right.
Well, because the difference is people are thinking like digital is new. digital is not new.
No.
Paid digital
right.
is new. There's been pirating of comics for quite some time.
Oh, for sure.
And I think that's one of the factors that's eaten into comic print sales.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how that's playing out with all this new digital stuff and whatnot, I don't know. I will say, at the Wizard World Austin, I did see a booth. You know how they've always got these ones with bootleg videos and stuff?
Yeah.
There was one that had the DC New 52, both all the number ones and all the number twos.
Did it really?
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
And it's like all of them on CBR format, or, you know, the which is, I guess, one of the main pirating
How
formats.
Can he be selling that outright there? I mean, that's crazy.
Same way they're selling the bootleg pirated version of the Wonder Woman pilot. Or, you know, this whole fan-to-fan copying thing. And, hey, I've got a couple of things I bought as bootlegs over the years, no question about that.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I mean, but there's some stuff, it's like, that was really cool as a kid, I'd like to get a copy of it. You know, and it's some of the stuff the copyright owners have either gone out of business or simply not released. But
the biggest,
for something like the New 52, which day and date digital is out there, come on.
The biggest blatant copyright I ever saw was... I was at the Motor City Comic Con, and I think it must have been, what year was the first Spider-Man? 2000, 2001?
Sounds about right.
Yeah, 2000, because right after the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. And they had, so I'm at the Motor City Con, and the movie came out that weekend. And sure enough, you know, some guys are in one of the booths, like, hey, look at this, I got the Spider-Man right on DVD, you can buy it, here's a copy. And he's sitting there with his computer burning copies.
Wow.
And sure enough, a couple hours later, the guy was hauled away into jail.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, man. But
just crazy.
Talk about stroking your ego, too. It's like, man, you know, put that away. You know, make your copies and sell it at home. Don't sell it in the middle of the floor. I mean, man, word got out quickly.
Hey, what I like about comic book conventions is you can find stuff that you just can't find somewhere else. But, man, I much prefer if it's, you know, legal stuff and they're not ripping off the copyright holders.
Mm-hmm.
Because, while I don't really care that much about the corporations, per se, I would like them to be making the money on this property to where they can put more of it out. You know, I probably could have gotten the role-playing game stuff or the Villains and Vigilante stuff online, in print, at a cheaper price.
Yeah.
But this way, the guy who's behind the property, who's actually doing the stuff, you know, he got the sale. You know, and to me, that's a good thing.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I've always wanted to get the old 1960s Marvel superheroes cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the Jack Kirby renditions and everything so square. You know, you know, it's so bad. They always had bootleg copies at the cons, but, you know, after looking at the reissues of, like, the Legion of Doom series that they got out on DVD a couple years ago, you know, I'd like a really nice, crisp, clean copy of that.
Yeah.
And I'm holding out hope that someday it'll happen.
Yeah, sooner or later. I mean, I think eventually all of this stuff is going to come out on DVD, is going to get collected, be it the comics, whatever. I mean, the material is there. And there's such risk in producing new material sometimes that it's smart money to take some proven material and put it back out in the market.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at all the old 70s and 80s TV shows coming out on DVD.
Well, and we're still waiting for the Batman TV show to come out.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crappy as that is, and it's fun to watch. I mean, it should be out. And then we can always go over, you know, the Neil Gaiman, Alan Moore, Marvel Man. You know, just put it out. You know, you guys are going to make a ton of money. Instead of people like me bootlegging it, you know, not that I bootleg, I have my own copy, but
right,
you know, I'm not one to redistribute it back in the BitTorrent market.
Yeah,
but I, you know, when that comes out, I'm there. I'll buy that omnibus, you know, and so will, you know, 100,000 other people probably.
I will
as
say
long as
though,
they still remember what it is.
Yeah, there is that, you know. It's worth doing some searches, though, on Amazon from time to time, because I picked up the Captain America movie, and because I hadn't seen that in the theater, I picked it up on DVD.
Right.
And when I was going looking for it on Amazon and stuff, although I wound up getting it locally, I noticed that they had the old Reb Brown stuff, those two movies on a single DVD, and then the Matt Salinger one that they did back in... when was that? I think it was the 92 or whatever. It was the other one that had the Red Ronnie Skull
Cox.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
And that both of those were out as legit DVDs. It's like, great, I'll pick them up.
Yeah.
You know, this is stuff that I'm sure bootleggers somewhere have and stuff. It's, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But it's all cool.
Well, the Fantastic Four, I think I've got that on. I bootleg that, too.
Yeah.
The Roger Corman, which is awful.
Oh, yes.
It's really bad.
Hey, but it served its purpose. It kept the copyright for that studio because they used it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when you've got that use it or lose it clause, I mean, that's the sort of thing that happens.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, I wish that that use it or use it clause would get used a bit more in the comics realm, both in terms of exclusivity agreements, but more in terms of when a creator takes a property to a publisher. There are a couple of things that, you know, I think are getting stuck, and maybe I'm wrong and maybe this just isn't happening, but stuck at publishers that aren't getting the material out or whatever, and maybe that the property would do better at another publisher or what have you.
Well, didn't they, I mean, I don't want to get a copyright, we can talk about this for years, but didn't they, didn't Walt Disney rewrite the copyright laws in favor of his properties?
Well, not him personally, but his lawyers were lobbying.
Yeah.
And that's part of why the copyright law got extended a number of times.
Right.
It really goes back to Mickey Mouse and trying to keep that protected.
Right.
I believe that was one of the main things behind the copyright extension. I'm thinking of 72 and then the later one, which I forget when that was.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, copyrights last a lot longer now than they used to.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, part of it's both the copyright stuff, but also, you know, just, again, keeping things in print and really doing right by the properties. So...
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. So, what's coming up on your show? I mean, we've already talked about what's going on with
you. You know, not much. Just kind of gearing up for the year-end kind of stuff coming up.
Wow, it's already getting to year-end.
I know. It's mid-November, John. We got to start thinking about that stuff. So yeah, just, you know, I'm kind of curating my top 20 list, and I am going to whittle that down to a top 10 list. But, yeah, and, you know, I think I'm going to do some funny thing this year. You know, I usually go over the top books of the year.
Mm-hmm.
I might do my top, my least favorite top five. And if I had to pick a, you know, kind of like, a, you know, the Golden Raspberry Awards, they do. I mean, not worse, but, you know, something funny. It would have to be the Women of Marvel Omnibus that came out for over 1,000 pages for $100. I just think that was just a flop, what that thing was. You know, like, what were they thinking kind of thing.
I tell you, there's a couple of things like that over at Marvel at times.
Yeah.
It's like, really?
Yeah, that too. So.
Cool.
What about you?
Well, let's see. We've got the Weekly Comic Spotlight. Let's see. We're recording this today, which is the 14th. It'll go up on the 25th. We've done the preview stuff between now and then. What's going up after that? I actually don't know what's going to be on the next Weekly Comic Spotlight at this point. We will decide that.
Bob will let you know.
Well, Bob and I will figure it out. It's getting a little hard. Bob has successfully cut down his list.
Yes.
And congratulations to him on that, but it's making picking some of the stuff a little bit harder.
Yes.
Now, in fairness, the books I just got today, on Monday the 14th, I've actually had time to read through almost my entire selection of independent books. I read three of the four, and the fourth is what we're going to cover on the weekly spotlight that goes up on the 21st, which would be the Monday before this got released.
Mm-hmm.
But really, it's the usual stuff. We're still doing the preview spotlight. That's going well. We always like people to send in submissions. I like to get suggestions on what I should be reading, and I want people to tempt Bob back into more titles. I'm trying to get a little work done on enhancing the number crunching process, just because the system I'm currently using, the same one as I've been using forever, starting to collapse under the weight of, say, 52 new reused titles and little things like that.
Right.
I mean, really, the industry has changed over the 10 years since I first put this number crunching system together.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways good, in some ways you've got to use this title yet again, stop it, you know, kind of things. And then trying to figure out what we're going to be doing for the year end and stuff. Fortunately for the mail report aspect, I get a little bit of a reprieve, and that doesn't happen until like January, but when those numbers come out in January, I get the December and the year end pretty much all at once.
Right.
And I'm hoping to get to where I can handle that a lot faster and easier than how it's been going lately. But really, it's for me, the big thing is just keeping up on my reading. I'm getting a lot of books still. This felt like a small week with only about 35 comics.
Oh, jeez.
And there's something just not quite right about that. So I may start looking at, do I want to cut back too or not?
Right.
But, you know, I'm enjoying most of what I'm reading. So there are a couple of things on the new 52 I'm hanging on to just because, well, you know, if I get all 52, I get a better discount through DCBS. But, you know, once that stops, a couple of those titles will go away, probably.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, nothing really huge in store. We're continuing to go. We're actually not that far away from episode 600 of the podcast.
Oh, wow. Okay. I think we'll hit that
before the end of the year.
Jeez.
So, you know, it's fun to do, but, man, it keeps me busy.
Yeah, no kidding.
So.
Good deal, man.
Yep. Anything else, or does that do it?
No, I think we're done.
Cool. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening. The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If they differ from your reality, please verify you're in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. If you're a resident of some other space-time continuum, please limit any actions you may take to that alternate reality. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. Diamond Order Index only goes to 2 decimal places, and therefore there's a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. For months in which no issue of Batman or Detective shipped, Batman: The Battle for the Cowl was used instead. The title used as the key title is irrelevant. If you do not understand why or do not believe this, please consider taking a refresher course on basic algebra. Math is fun, but only if you understand it. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Sell-through information is not currently available, and we limit our reporting to the available information. If, however, you enjoy fiction, please listen to this preview spotlight for our recommendations of upcoming comic books. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications that at least one retailer may have excessive amounts of empty shelf space with dust that needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold to Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 300 comic books for the month in question. The list of the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to the retailers for the month in question. More than 300 graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, the list of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 100, 50, 25, or as few as 10 items on the list. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which, as far as we know, has not been invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic book, graphic novel, or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 300 graphic novels and collected edition lists are included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. For some strange reason, Diamond doesn't report on sales to competing distributors. No information about the sales or lack of sales of any item sold outside of Diamond's comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. We limit this report to the available data. If more data becomes available, we'd be happy to include it. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for. No amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer is here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is inapplicable in the alternate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Math, logic, and the English language itself seem to work very differently there. I have neither the time nor the interest in engaging in pointless debates in this hypothetical reality. There are no guarantees of accuracy, reliability, completeness, or timeliness of any of the information given in the course of this discussion. We are human, and sometimes we make mistakes. We appreciate your understanding in this area. Any statements that may contain projections or other predictions about future events should be viewed as opinions that are subject to change as new information becomes available. Actual events may unfold in unexpected ways. As Doc Brown once said, the future is what you make of it. If any statements are contradicted or contested, the participants of the discussion may disavow any knowledge of those statements.